Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Over the past 40, 50 years, family dynamics in this country have changed very significantly. It has become increasingly common for women to work outside the home and for men to be involved in childcare. It is also true, though, that the pace of change in gender relations has slowed. It's certainly not quite as dramatic as it was in perhaps in the 60s and the 70s. And that has led some people to conclude that this thing that we call the gender revolution, perhaps it's over. Some people even think that in gender relations we have perhaps taken a few steps back. We have drifted back to the attitudes of earlier generations. Well, this morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some of the most recent research on how men and women live their lives and what they want, particularly when it comes to things like family and work. And our guest is sociologist Barbara Reisman. And she says, contrary to what some people might conclude, the gender revolution is not coming to an end. In fact, she says something interesting has happened. When you take a look at attitudes about life and work, it seems that men and women are actually becoming more alike. Our guest, Barbara Reisman, is professor and head of the Department of Sociology at the University of Illinois Chicago, and she's joining us by telephone. As we talk, questions from listeners are welcome. We do ask that people try to be brief, and we ask that so we can keep moving along, get in as many callers as possible, but you're certainly welcome to call with your questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, wherever the signal will travel. If you're listening on the internet, you can also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. At any point you have a question, you can give us a call. Professor Reisman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, we certainly, the thing that caught my eye and got me thinking about this was a story that I read about a conference that you were involved in back in early May. This was the conference of the Council on Contemporary Families, and it was the 10th anniversary conference. So you and another scholar, Molly Lang from Bloomsburg University, Pennsylvania, got together and did a kind of a review of some of the studies looking at these very kinds of issues, things like women in the workforce and attitudes about who can do what and what people were doing in the home. And I want to talk about that, and we'll talk about each of those things in a little bit of detail. But just in as a general point, do you think that, in fact, that what's happened here is that if you look at where we are now and look at where we were in the 50s, you can see that there has been very significant change. The thing is that maybe we've kind of gotten used to it now. You know, we have at least three generations that have come of age and been involved in parenting and marriage since the second wave of feminism. And maybe we're just we've gotten used to these kinds of changes, and for that reason, we don't really think about them that much anymore.
I think that it's an interesting question if we don't think about them as much as we used to. But I think I disagree that that's the case. It seems to me every time I turn around, there's an article in the newspaper where someone is claiming that women are opting out of the labor force, or that men that no one's taking paternity leaves. And so I actually think when you follow or track what people are talking about, if journalists are in fact covering what's on people's minds, I think that this is still a pretty serious topic of conversation. And I think it is, in fact, still an issue that couples negotiate on an everyday basis in their own lives. Mm-hmm. So I think that although we certainly are no longer, this is new and radical and no one's ever heard of this, that in fact it's sort of in the middle of a lot of social change, and that even though it's been around for a long time, that when people, each new generation, each new couple that has to negotiate life, has their first child, the issues arise again.
Yeah. Well, I certainly do think that it's true that women and men are still wrestling with basic questions like, well, what does it mean to be a woman? What does it mean to be a man? What does that mean for the way I behave in the world? What's that mean for the way that I relate to the opposite gender? And they're still struggling with things like, how do we make a relationship, and how do we keep that over a long term, and what happens when children come into it, and all that kind of thing. I guess I just wonder if somehow the are we still asking the same questions in the same way that we did 30 years ago? Are the questions slightly different?
I think the questions and the issues are very different. When 30 years ago, when I started teaching, I would ask in a classroom of 200 kids, how many of you have parents who are divorced? And just a few hands would go up. Then I would ask, how many of you know anyone in your family, aunt, uncle, cousins? And then more hands would go up. In a classroom today, if you ask how many people's parents are divorced, you get about half, and so right away kids are growing up in a very different world where families are in much more flux than they used to be. I think that's tremendously different. I also think that the presumption now is in a college classroom, when you ask a group of kids, how many of you intend to be in the labor force for the rest of your life? You don't get any different response from women and men. 30 years ago, you got a terrifically different response from women and men. And that, I think, is a major difference, is that kids today, women as well as men, presume that they're going to finish school, go into the labor force, and basically work for the rest of their lives, whether or not they become mothers or fathers. And I think that's very different. I think in previous generations, employment for young women was seen as something that was optional if they were wives. And I think that very few young women today go through their higher education presuming they're not going to use it for most of their life.
Yeah. Well, just to take a look at some of the conclusions that you and your colleague did when you reviewed some of this material and studies that had been done. There, we just touched on one thing that that's most people will recognize, that in fact, over the last 40 years or so, in increasing numbers, women have gone into the paid labor force, and so now there has been an expansion of women who are working outside the home, a slight perhaps contraction actually in men's rates of employment, so that we actually are getting to the point where the gap has closed, and the numbers of men and women in the workforce are getting rather close.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is that they're closer in the younger age ranges. That is, the younger generations are much closer than the older ones. And that's a part of this, what we call gender convergence, the way men and women live their lives are much more similar than they used to be. They are not the same. It is still the case that women in the 21st century are more likely to scale back their paid work when they first have children than men are. They're likely to work fewer hours. But the difference, the gap, continues to shrink over time. And if you look at attitudes, what you find in the most recent studies of 20-somethings and young people in their 30s is that the men and the women tell you that if they had their druthers, if they could organize their lives entirely the way they'd like, they would work somewhat less than their parents did, spend a little bit more time with their kids. But the men and the women have the same responses. You couldn't tell the difference in how men and women of this generation actually would like to spend their time. Mm-hmm. There's a really fascinating study that we talk a little bit about in our report by Kathleen Gerson, which suggests that this is true. Men and women of the up-and-coming generation really do want to live their lives very similarly, but they have very interestingly different plan Bs, If this doesn't work out for you, what's plan B? And the men say, well, a wife who works part-time. The men say, if this doesn't work out well, then it's okay if my partner doesn't stay in the labor force full-time. What the women say is, if this doesn't work out, I'll do it on my own. That the women are very, very leery of removing themselves from the labor force and depending on their own economic stability and that of their kids on a marriage, because they come from a generation where they've seen one too many marriages fall apart and one too many not equally earning women fall into economic hard time.
Mm. Well, certainly something else that we have seen is that people are, young men and women, men and women are delaying marriage. They're getting married at a later age than in the past on average. If you ask, say, you get a group of men and women today in their 20s, and you ask them, do you expect that someday that you will get married, and do you expect that someday that you will be a parent? And then you compare that to the kind of response you'd get to those same questions if you asked men and women in their 20s, you say, let's go back to the 1950s, you know, mm-hmm. the post-war period. If you ask them that same question, has there been much of a change in people's expectations of marriage and having kids?
That's a good question. I think that the data there suggests that, by and large, people who have the option to marry, that is, people who are heterosexual, tell you pretty much that most everyone says that eventually they want to get married. That hasn't changed very much. How they want to run that marriage might have changed, but the normative expectation that people would like to find a life partner and marry them has been remarkably stable. There is an increase in the number of people who say they want to be voluntarily childless, and that has increased. And the real increase, not only in what people want, but what people are doing, is the number of very small families, the number of people who have one child has skyrocketed. It's about 1 out of 5 now. And so that's what's really changed. Not that fewer people want to get married, but fewer people want to have families. And of those people who do want to have families, they have smaller families. And so that's really what has changed there. And I think that has to do with a very, what I think is in some sense is the most important ongoing, really, crisis for families. And that is the way the labor force and workplaces are structured. When you think about a job that expects someone to leave their house every morning at 7 and come home every night at 6, including commuting time, 50 weeks a year, or maybe if you're in a good job, 49 or 48 weeks a year with no flexibility during the working hours, the only way that that job could have been so designed was if you presumed that person had no moral or practical responsibilities for anybody but themselves, for any young people, for aging parents, even really for their own food, you know, upkeep, their own sort of keeping their own homes going. The whole way we've organized the labor force for full-time jobs really assumed at some, if not conscious, very clear level that workers had wives, and wives who were domestic workers, that when you paid someone a salary, you were really paying them a family wage, a wage that allowed the worker to go to work, the domestic wife to be everything domestic wives were, from emotional caregivers to maids to chauffeurs to cooks, bottle washers, and the support of children. We continue to have the same way we've organized our workplaces, but now most men don't have wives who do all of this, and female workers very rarely have stay-at-home husbands, although, you know, that too is rising. And so what we have is a real misfit between the way people live their lives, which is that people who have kids and aging parents that need them occasionally, or even more than occasionally, during working hours, have jobs that presume that they don't have any responsibilities but that paycheck. And I think that's really where the crisis is for American families, is how to reorganize workplaces so that this gender convergence, this reality that both men and women have responsibilities not only for earning a paycheck but also for caring for other human beings, we have to somehow make that possible.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Barbara Reisman. She is professor and head of the Department of Sociology at University of Illinois Chicago. And we're talking about some of the recent research that takes a look at men and women and how they live their lives, their attitudes, particularly toward work and family. If you have questions, comments, certainly you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk a little bit more about what it is we know about men and women at home. And I think that for some time, the observation was that now that women had moved increasingly into the workforce, not only were they taking on those responsibilities and doing that kind of work out of the home, but they still were primarily doing the work in the home. Primarily, they were doing most of the child care, they were doing the cooking, they were doing the cleaning, and that we had a lot written about the fact that there were women who now were essentially working almost 24 hours a day, and that while men were helping, they were not up to doing half of all of this kind of stuff. So if you take a look at now where we are right now, and particularly look at men's involvement in just all of the general maintenance things that have to go on around the house, and also in childcare and how involved they are with their children, where do we stand now, and particularly how has that, if again we go back and make our comparisons between, you know, go back 40, 50 years, how does today compare with then?
We're still nowhere. We're still not at half. That's for sure. Men are women who are employed the same number of hours as the men to whom they are married are still doing more than half of the child care and housework. The child care is getting closer to equal than the housework is, but every generation is getting closer, and that I think is a very optimistic sign that it's absolutely the case that when women went into the labor force full time and started working as many hours as men, and in many cases earning incomes near what their husbands earned, there were predictions, mine included, back in the 1970s and 80s, that men would that the family roles would change equally quickly. That it really was that family roles were really about power and income, and that as women had as much income as men, they would have enough power in their households to insist everything be equal very quickly. That did not happen. Instead, what we find is that the work that women and men do at home with their kids and to clean and keep their homes oriented is much deeper rooted in the sense of being a good woman, a good wife, a good man, and a good husband. It's less about pure power politics and more about how people do gender, how they feel, how we've raised girls to feel good about themselves and boys to feel good about themselves. And so it has taken a longer time, really, for that to change. But what we find when we look at the data over 50 years is that the trends are all in the right direction, that every year and every generation, men are doing more. Where they're doing more first is childcare, because I think we can all agree that the work that involves taking care of kids, there's tremendous psychological payback from that, you know. It's just quick and really wonderful turnaround with time you spend with your own kids. It's probably less positive immediate feedback from having a clean sink or bathroom toilet, you know, bathroom bowl or something. And men haven't moved as quickly into those roles, but they're too. The sort of household division of labor every year and every generation is, in fact, moving in the right direction. There's no longer the stigma. Men are not doing as much, but there's no longer the stigma about sort of teasing or you're not a real man if men are changing diapers or cleaning up around the house. They are, in fact, being good fathers and being good husbands. And I think that's a pretty significant change. And so I'm very optimistic about the change happening towards equality. It's just not happening quite as quickly as perhaps second wave feminists had hoped.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back and pick up on something because I think that it's an interesting question, and I know that it's something that scholars have wrestled with and probably continue to do, and that is how it is we think about gender. And when I use that term, I guess what I think about is in a manner of speaking, it's the job description that we are handed. The one top of one says woman, top of the other one says man. It says this is how you're supposed to behave. This is what it's all mm-hmm. about. And there certainly was a time when people were making this argument that said this job description, this business of gender, what we think of being a woman and man, it's totally socially constructed. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are biological differences between men and women. There's no getting away from that. But this other thing, it's just a matter of in a some kind of collective way, consciously or unconsciously, we've all sat down and decided, okay, this is how men behave. This is how women behave. And that has to do. So when you ask how it is that boys and girls are the way that they are, it has a lot to do with how it is we raise them. It's mm-hmm. it's all about socialization. And now if we're coming to appreciate maybe somewhat more that, yes, socialization has a lot to do with the people that we are, but, you know, you can't quite get away from wiring. That brings something to the party. How now do you think scholars are thinking about this whole idea, and do you still want to make that argument that gender primarily is a social construction?
Well, that's an interesting question. It actually happens to be a research project I'm right now smack in the middle of. And so I'll tell you a little bit about, first of all, let me start by responding to how, when you say the word gender, I think about it, and then mm-hmm. come back and respond to the issue of wiring and hormones.
Okay.
I think that absolutely, when you say the word, what gender means, a big part of it is what individual boys and girls are, what inside we think of ourselves, what we carry around with us as our sort of femininity and masculinity sense of self. And I think that's surely what psychologists and sociologists have often meant. I think in the last 20 years, there have been other meanings given it's sort of been expanded, certainly in my own work, and that is gender not only exists at the level of our individual sense of who we are, but gender is also built into the way we run organizations, that organizations that are structured in such a way to presume that that the people who succeed in them never have babies, don't have bodies that get pregnant and breastfeed, are organizations that have structured masculinity or maleness into the very ability to succeed in them. So that it's not just people that have gender, but organizations are gendered in such a way that they've made the rules to win in the game outside of individual life sort of privileging one sex. And so that it's not just people that are gendered, it's the way we run organizations and businesses and schools that are also gendered. So that gender doesn't just exist in organizations, the way we've constructed it doesn't exist in people. It's also, gender exists in the way we've built our society. So that, and I think that that's a really important breakthrough in the way we think about gender in the last 20 years. And I think that it's something that academics use and researchers and sociologists use, but hasn't really, really been very well explained to people who are not doing this kind of research. You know, everyday folks don't understand that we really look at the way the world is gendered, not just people are gendered. And so that, I think, is an important component to put into this. And the way when what we teach grown, not only childhood and socialization, but when people get married, the role husband and wife, what that means, what they're expected, and how we judge them. That is, if you go into somebody's house and it's really dirty, you're unlikely to think, boy, that guy's a bad husband. But you're very likely to think, boy, that woman isn't a very good wife. And so that there's sort of these expectations that we build into adult social roles that are also gendered. And I think that's important. The biological question is a really good one. And that is, I actually would have said maybe 10 years ago that hormones made absolutely no difference in people's sense of self. I actually, my own research suggests that indeed there is some, but not, there is indeed some significant causal relationship between hormonal factors, particularly in the second trimester in utero, and senses of particularly nurturance 20 years, 30 years later among women. We don't actually have data. I haven't actually looked at this data among men. But what that means for society is the question. That is, it could be that people who are particularly empathetic, you might say, make really good mothers. Yes, maybe. But they probably make really good stockbrokers, too, if they can empathetically figure out what people's concerns are and tell their clients to put their money in those kind of products. And so I don't think we have to imagine that bodies don't have any effect on human beings or who we think we are, but what we do with that and how we, whether or not we use that in ways that create a society that's sort of rewards men and women equally, or we create these categories of privilege that only privilege one sex or the other, I think is really what we need to think about.
We are just a little bit past our midpoint. I have a couple of callers we'll get to. And let me introduce again our guest, Barbara Reisman. She is a sociologist. She's head of the Department of Sociology and professor of sociology at University of Illinois Chicago. And this is a subject that she has been dealing with in her teaching and research and writing for a long time, has written a number of articles. And maybe one book I just mentioned, it's not new, but I think that what it has to say is still applicable to where we are now. And that's a book that's titled Gender Vertigo, American Families in Transition. It was published in 1998 by the Yale University Press. I'm sure you could take a look at it and find it in the library or possibly in the bookstore. And questions are welcome. Again, though, we ask people to try to be brief here. We're moving now into our last 25 minutes, and it will help us to keep things moving along if callers can make their points and make room for other folks. First up here, Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi, Professor Reisman. You talk about the trend toward work equality. You say that it's moving us in the right direction. Notice the value judgment. Is it the right direction for children, though? You know, virtually all social scientists say that the ideal environment for children is a stable family. You know, strong marriage, loving relationship, family security, wholesome. Wholesome gender role models, to the degree now that social evolution has produced insecure families and confused gender role models, what is the effect on children?
Okay, I think there are two different issues in your question, both of them very good. I totally agree that anything that isn't good for the next generation isn't good for anybody. So we have a value judgment that we share there. In terms of stability, I think it's absolutely the case that research suggests that stable families, not only stable families, but stable settings, stable context for children is, in fact, produces the best outcome. The kids with the less at-risk variables, if they live in stable settings. It's not at all clear to me that stable settings without good, loving relationships is good for kids. In fact, there's pretty good evidence that stable, conflictual marriages are really bad for kids.
Right.
So I think we have to be really careful about the stability issue. But it's also the case that that's a totally separate issue from there being a hierarchical marriage system where sort of fathers are in the living, mothers stay home with kids. I think that there's not any good research that suggests that having this dichotomized, daddy earns the sort of leave it to beaver, daddy earns a living, mommy stays home, is particularly a positive role model, particularly for girls. And so I think we have to separate out. I do think that there is evidence that stability in one's family setting is a good thing for kids. I don't think there's good evidence that that family has to be a traditional one where fathers have more power or income production capabilities than mothers. In fact, I actually think that when you have two income earners in a family, what you have is two people who understand each other's lives better and perhaps better and stronger relationships. The most recent research on household division of labor actually shows that the more housework, the more equal a partner a man is in raising the kids and working in the household, the higher the satisfaction level in the marriage, the happier the marriage is for the wife, which seems to me is pretty good for stability. I also want to say one other thing about stability, and that is it's really true that stability matters for kids. It's also true that that doesn't necessarily always, in every circumstance, mean that mothers and fathers should be married, because I think it's really clear that if mothers are divorced and then remarry again, it's not clear that having married parents itself is what's good for kids, because marriage, divorce, remarriage adds one more instability into a kid's life. And so I think, I'm not saying that remarriage is bad, I just think that these are very complicated questions about what's good for kids, and that there's no one-size-fits-all that's what's right for kids. And when I say in the right direction, the value underneath my argument here is about social justice. It's about equality for women and men, and I think that's important for kids, too.
Well, now, it's clear we're not going to get the traditional family back again. That traditional family is probably gone forever. But we haven't quite made the modern family work yet, have we? We're in the process of making that work.
I think that we tend to romanticize the past. If you're really interested in whether or not we have a better or worse situation for kids and for families now than in the past, there's two historians whose work I heartily recommend. One is Stephanie Kuntz, and she has a new book called The History of Marriage, or Marriage, a History. She also has a wonderful book called The Way We Never Were. And Stephen Mintz has a book about the history of childhood. And I would just like to suggest that although we have this notion that everything was really better sometime in the past, I actually think when you look at the outcome variables on overall kids' lives, you don't find that there's a romantic moment in history when they had lives in better than now in terms of the numbers of kids who are in school, out of dangerous settings. In poor kids 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, were in mines. They were in factories. When you actually look at the overall picture for kids' lives, I'm not at all convinced that overall kids' lives aren't better now than they were before modernization. There are some things that are harder, but there are some things that are a lot better for kids.
I want to thank the caller for his comments. We're now getting into about our less than 15 minutes left. We have some other callers and want to go next to Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Thank you for the reference. That book title actually came right into my mind. It usually does when the previous caller comes, The Way We Never Were. I wanted to introduce the idea of complicating the issue with race, class, and gender, the big trifecta, because I think it's important. And I wanted to, this idea of the value of domestic work, women's work always demeaned, making a household and making a warm and loving place to live, it should be a challenge for everyone, it seems. But I wanted to introduce something in from the institution, and it has to do with the history of the U of I and the way they got domestic cleaning done, basically. I guess it isn't domestic. In the 30s and the 40s, before World War I, basically, which is seen as a big change in the way women were treated in society because of Rosie the Riveter and all that, the cleaning in the U of I was done by African Americans. Males were in the manly parts of the buildings, and women cleaned the housing, basically. And this is true very, very, almost entirely. I mean, there were exceptions, but mm-hmm. After World War II, you know, women had worked in the workplace, men, 3 million were abroad, et cetera, so there were a lot of changes, and women went abroad, too, in a large way. So, men came back, the civil service was constructed, and GI Bill, and all the jobs were then given to white males, returning veterans. The blacks were turned out, and I guess maybe some of the women still did the housing cleaning, but... then that took a long time for a woman to get on the workforce, you know, doing things that are, you know, should have been regarded as, you know, and it took a long time, even a longer time for African Americans to get back on. So I just wanted you to try to place this whole discourse. I really take your point about child labor too, because I think that when people are romanticizing the previous family, they're ignoring the Industrial Revolution, as it was called. And the fact that, you know, they had no childhood at all.
Right.
In those days.
Yeah, there
so
was.
I appreciate the way you handled the last, and I'll hang up and listen and let some other people in. Thank you.
I think that your point is really well taken, and actually I should have made it myself before, and that is that the way gender convergence works and family patterns are changing are terrifically complicated and differentiated by social class and by race and ethnicity. It is the case, I think, that working class men often actually do more than they're willing to say, because in the past it had been so stigmatized, but in fact working class women have been in the labor force even when middle class women were not in the labor force. And so in that sense, there's been that sort of pressure. And so I actually think that sometimes what research suggests is that upper middle class men who buy into an ideology of equality and the new fatherhood are likely to exaggerate how much they do, and in fact working class men who are doing as much or more will sometimes downplay it somewhat because there's still more of a traditional notion there that it may hurt their sense of masculinity. Where the real sort of very major difference is that gender convergence and the sort of more men and women living more similar lives does not happen in communities where high unemployment rates. That there seems to be a process where unless men are in some senses doing well at the traditional male roles, that is, they are breadwinners, then if they're not breadwinners, they're unlikely to either stay in marriage, be or stay in marriages, or move over, sort of add the more traditionally valued work of children and household labor. What we see is tremendous sort of movement of men away from family life at all in communities where there is very high unemployment, and then what we have is single mothers who, you know, do everything. They're in the labor force, they have kids, they're totally doing both traditionally male and female roles, but with very little involvement of men in their kids' lives at all, and I think that is well worth saying and saying out loud and worrying about.
All right, let's go on to another caller. Bondville is the person here, line number two. Hello.
Yes, I have a couple of questions. When the changes that the Americans are putting on in the Mideast and introducing our ideas and traditions, do you think that's hard for the men there to accept that kind of change? I guess I seem to think that they're fighting against that type of change where the Americans want to introduce our the women working and et cetera. And that's one question I have. Let's see if you have a comment about that. And The other question I have, this is kind of a crazy question, but a guy had wrote a book called Manliness. I don't know if you read that or not. I didn't read it either, but I saw the gentleman interviewed on a show and by a woman and just tearing the guy up, you know, every time he would try to make a say something about what he thought manliness was. It was quite comical, but anyway, that's my comments. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, I want to say that the issues around gender in the Middle East are, in fact, not my research issues, so I'm not an expert on this. I will think out loud a little bit about it, and what I'm hearing the question being is whether or not all the changes around modernization, including women's rights and equality for women and women changing gender relations, are part of what sort of traditional men are angry about and sort of reacting against in the Middle East. And, you know, I don't know. That's a fascinating research question. It seems to me that it's a possibility that there's a whole lot that is, in fact, part of modernization. And I don't actually even think that it's Americans somehow imperialistically spreading this. There are, in fact, homegrown, very active feminist transnational organizations in every Mid East country, from Iran to Iraq, feminist magazines. This is I don't think we should think about these changes as something that somehow Americans are imposing elsewhere. The world is a small place these days. Globalization is not only about the economy, it's very much about social movements and social change and ideology. The internet has had an amazing impact on transnational social movements, on people with ideas about how society should be talking to one another directly. And so have NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and bringing together people from other societies to have conferences and conversations. And so I do think that this is at play in other parts of the world, but I don't think it's about America sort of spreading this in some imperialistic way.
Just there's something else I'm interested in having you reflect on, and we'll see if we can get at least one more caller in. And this is something now that's going back some ways, but I'm thinking about how some years back there was some attention paid in the popular media to the fact that young women, even young college age women and educated women, shied away from calling themselves feminists, and this really galled the women of the second wave, who would have been maybe literally or metaphorically, you know, their moms and their aunts, those women who would want to say to the younger women and said, there are many things about your lives that are better because of feminism, and that it really irritated them that the young women didn't, there was something about the term that turned them off. And I'm interested in what you can say now about women, you know, maybe in their 20s and possibly even 30s, who were born after or came of age after the women's movement, and how they think about the movement, about feminism, and also about basic issues like equality as regards, you know, men and women.
I think that's a great question. There's several questions embedded in that one. The first one is, I do absolutely think that there was a way in which conservative talk show hosts and pundits turned feminism into a bad word, sort of feminazi, the sort of notion that somehow feminists hated men, they were nasty, brutish, all these sort of very, I think, carefully constructed stereotypes about what feminism meant. And I think that scared away women, younger women who were not part of the generation who sort of fought for equality in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, sort of grew up with this notion that feminists were bra-burning man-haters. That's what they read. That was the definition they were given. And they, you know, who wouldn't shy away from that, right? But actually, I think it's very much been rediscovered. There's a whole third wave feminist movement that is really quite different than the second wave, much less focused on politics, much more focused on culture and ideas and music. And so in that sense, you know, that's, the third wave is younger women redefining it because they take for granted the rights the second wave so fought for. You know, what we, in the second wave, you know, the right to stay in the labor force even after we had children and be considered, you know, equal pay for equal work, those kinds of things, they, although it's not there all the way, they take it for granted. They don't think they have to fight for this. And so they focus on more cultural kinds of representational issues. And so I do think that that's there. Beyond that, I sort of want to say when I start a class, I teach classes on gender and people, you know, the question of what is feminism and how does that relate to what is gender and what do you do when someone, you know, writes a book and calls herself or himself a feminist scholar, what does that mean? And so I often put three questions up on the board at the, you know, when we get to this conversation. One of them is, do you think men and women are equal in today's society? Do you think they ought to be equal? And ask people to put up their hands, you know, and people who put up their hands instead of both are right, sometimes they add a third, would you do anything in your life, either personally or politically, to work towards women's equality with men? You know, by the time you do that, almost every hand in the room is up. And then I look around and I say, well, according to my definition, you are all feminists.
Hmm. let's try and get at least, we have a couple of Urbana callers here. I'd like to try to get at least one more. Line one, this is Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm a feminist and have raised two feminist sons who've chosen strong women for their spouses. And I have a long-term marriage. And it's interesting to watch the son who has children now, to watch him and his wife coming up with their own personally specific ways of dealing with parenthood and work. She's, because of her biology work in an area that was dangerous health-wise to any developing fetus, she stopped working outside the home in labs and now is a stay-at-home mom at the moment, which she has chosen to do. But my son, from what I can see, is very, very much involved in child care and works at a company that has set up working hours so that every other weekend he's got a longer weekend. So it's just interesting to watch how each of us make our own choices.
Mm-hmm.
Another observation was that I happened to pick up a book for a young feminist about current feminist issues, and before I returned it to the library, and I hadn't had a chance to read it, but I just opened up the page, and there was a page that said that homophobia and anti-homosexual sentiments were really an indication of hatred of women. Because what it means is people can't deal with men who seem to show feminine traits and with women who do not need a man.
Mm.
I thought, this is a really interesting observation. I have to think about this some more. And gave some examples, too. For instance, a coach who didn't like the way one of his players was playing and put a tampon in his locker. You know, or players being, athletic males being put down as throwing like a girl, or things like this. I think some of these things are changing, but it was an interesting insight to me how much there still is a feeling that women are less than men.
Mm-hmm.
We have a long way to go, but we've come very, very far, and thanks so much for what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I actually think that's a really good point, and that when we talk about gender relations, sometimes we forget that it's not really, I mean, what we're really talking about in some sense is inequality, that it's very, you know, that it's absolutely the case that when men are trying to deride other men, you know, in sports settings, in military sort of training areas, that the sort of language of putting each other down are don't be a woman, you know, wuss, wimp, things, don't be feminine, don't be, you know, you're being a girl. That's a negative, you know, that the sense that women are somehow not quite, you know, if a man wants to do something that is traditionally what women do, there's this stigma. And you don't get it the other way around. When women first wanted to be, you know, doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs, nobody said, "No, why would you want to do that?" Everybody got it. You know, that's where the power, property, you know, privilege was in our society. And so that I do think at this moment in history, it's very interesting. I have a study of middle school kids in process where it's really the case that boys have are much more likely to be constrained not to do girly things than girls are to be constrained not to do boy-like things at the moment. Because boys, and how boys are constrained is that if they want to dance or they want to do something, some activity that is traditionally feminine or female, people, the stigma they get isn't, oh, you're, you know, you're breaking a gender rule. They say, what other kids say to them is some homophobic insult. And so that homophobia is used as a policing mechanism to keep boys in a very tight set of behaviors in a way that is no longer true for girls.
Well, you know, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. It's been quite interesting to have the conversation, and perhaps there'll be another day we can talk. But for right now, we'll have to say thanks very much for giving us some of your time today.
Okay, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Our guest, Barbara Reisman, she's professor and head of the Department of Sociology at the University of Illinois, Chicago.